accompanying the president in the Beast, for sure, that highly guarded armored car that he's in, to take him from the Four Seasons Hotel to the Great Hall of the People, where President Xi Jinping will be waiting for him. And this is something all of us are looking for. It's the handshake, isn't it, Arnold? And I think the symbolism behind it. You see the flags. That's the Beast. Yep. You know he's in there.
Yep, somewhere in there, one of those cars, for sure. He will not be alone. He has a fairly large delegation traveling with him. Among them, the Scott Bessent is going to be there.
Treasury
as well.
Secretary.
The Treasury Secretary, because he's been at the forefront of advanced negotiations on the issue before the arrival, or before Mr. Trump arrived. And
Marco Rubio
will be there. Don't forget the 14 or so CEOs who will be there, because one of the top priorities for President Trump will be to walk away with deals, you know, for China to buy Boeing planes, you know, for China to buy soybeans, for example, for
beef.
China. There you go, right? A whole range of items that he'll be hoping to get to go home and, you know, talk about, you know, achieving success,
from
his summit.
Listen,
and we'll bring you...
we're looking at this closely.
...of the welcome ceremony for President Trump in Beijing before he holds bilateral talks with President Xi that's scheduled to take place in the next hour. Do also follow our live blog on our website, cna.asia, President Xi hosting his U.S. counterpart with full pomp and ceremony at the opulent Great Hall of the People, 10 a.m. local time. That's a reminder, followed by a bilateral meeting at 10:15. Stay with us as we bring you the latest updates, key moments and analysis as all the events unfold.
I'm Melissa, and today we're diving into something that's super relevant to many money-savvy Singaporeans, spending across the border in Johor. And with me is Mr. Pratik Bhattacharjee, who is here to share with us how UOB is transforming cross-border payments. So, welcome, Pratik.
Thank you for having me here. Really excited.
At UOB, you've been looking at card spending data. So, what are some of the trends you're seeing?
UOB serves across the region, across the five markets, more than 8.4 million customers. And we are the largest consumer credit card issuer for both Visa and MasterCard in ASEAN for Billix. What that means is that we really understand the pulse of the consumers and what is happening in their spending. Overall, cross-border spending on UOB cards in ASEAN markets went up by nearly 20% in the first half of 2025 compared to the same period in 2024. Our card data reveals that Johor is the top Malaysia city of choice for Singaporeans. As of June 2025, spending in Malaysia grew by 20%, with half of the spending in Johor.
Given Singaporeans' love of shopping in Johor, what credit card privileges can UOB offer to make their experiences more enjoyable?
UOB already offers credit and debit cards that work seamlessly overseas, from travel-centric cards like UOB Privy Miles credit card, Evol card with 0% FX fees, and multi-currency FX Plus debit card, to easy payments via Do It Now QR and fee-free overseas withdrawals at UOB ATMs. Our customers also get location-specific offers via our Rewards Plus program on UOB Tomorrow, which holds more than 1,000 local and regional deals.
That sounds exciting. So how would all that benefit someone like me?
So what we have done is to roll out what we call the cross-border rewards redemption. If you have an eligible UniDollar UOB credit card and you have accumulated enough UniDollars, you'll be able to use these points to offset your purchases at more than 150 shopping outlets in Johor.
You're telling me that now I can go on my shopping trips in Johor and use my reward points to pay?
You walk into one of those stores, take out your physical card, and you tap on the machine, and the machine will actually prompt you saying, do you want to pay with your points or with your card? Then you can actually choose pay with points, and we will actually deduct those points and pay the merchant. And you can walk away with the goods without paying a single dollar.
Now, the seamless cross-border lifestyle experience doesn't stop there, does it?
We have enhanced our FX Plus debit card, Evol credit card proposition with 0% FX fees also. So when customers are spending, they don't incur additional charges.
For anyone who's like planning a weekend trip to Johor, what's your tip?
Take your UOB card with you, whether it's your home country or beyond. Whether you want to tap, scan or use your points, it is your decision.
Our foreign ministers of the BRICS bloc are meeting in India today with the war in the Middle East and its impact on the Global South expected to top the agenda.
And China's foreign minister isn't attending on account of the Trump-Xi summit happening in Beijing. Also, BRICS chair India, it will be keeping a very close eye on that meeting with New Delhi's U.S. foreign policy shaped by frictions between the superpowers.
India will also hope to drive consensus on economic cooperation and help set the agenda ahead of a leaders' summit in September. Nia Punia reports for CNA from New Delhi.
This is the first major BRICS event that India is hosting as chair for this year, and it's taking place here at Bharat Mandapam in the heart of New Delhi. The theme of its presidency is building resilience, innovation, cooperation and sustainability. But experts say that idea is being put to test by the Iran war and its outsized impact on developing countries of the global south. BRICS nations represent more than 50% of the world's population and more than 40% of the global economy. Now, the bloc was originally set up to include Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. But today, it has 10 member nations, including Indonesia, which joined the bloc last year. It also includes Iran and the United Arab Emirates, two countries that are on opposing sides of the Iran-US war.
Foreign ministers of BRICS member countries will exchange views on global and regional issues of mutual interest on the second day. BRICS member and partner countries will participate in a session themed BRICS at 20, building for resilience, innovation, cooperation and sustainability.
Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi is here representing Tehran, his first visit to India since the war began. Tehran has previously called on the BRICS grouping to condemn America's actions. New Delhi will have a tough balancing act to execute, and experts say it will try to keep the focus on economic issues and not geopolitical conflicts.
Hopefully, through our steerage, through our role there as a chairperson who has relations with both sides, will be able to keep not just the group together, but in looking for a productive and a positive way forward, because this is a time of challenge for the global order.
India wants to project itself as a leader of the global south, but doesn't want to use this forum to criticize the US, a key trade partner with whom it is still finalizing a crucial trade pact. New Delhi said in March that building consensus has been difficult because of the involvement of some member nations in this conflict. Experts say the true test will now be whether or not a joint statement is issued at the end of the two-day meeting. A meeting of deputy foreign ministers in late April ended without a joint statement being issued, but New Delhi did issue a chair's statement. In talks with Iran's foreign envoy, experts say New Delhi will raise the safe passage of 13 Indian ships still stuck at the Strait of Hormuz. Now, India relies on the strait for 40% of its crude oil imports and 90% of its liquefied petroleum gas supplies. The strait's closure has hit India's energy security, even though New Delhi has still been able to avoid raising prices at fuel stations. For CNAM, Neha Punia in New Delhi.
Well, the war in Iran expected to feature in talks between Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping as they prepare to hold bilateral meetings. China is a major importer of Iranian and Middle East oil, so its economy could come under strain from the disruption caused by Tehran's Hormuz blockade and the U.S. naval siege on Iran. We'll take a look now at how Asian markets are performing as investors look ahead to that face-to-face meeting between the two leaders. Nikkei higher by 0.7%. The Kospi 1.6% higher. Singapore's STI is down about 0.4%. We've also got mainland Chinese markets coming online this hour with the Shanghai composite down about 0.1%, but gains there for the Shenzhen component as well as the Hang Seng. And two Chinese tech giants are also in focus this morning. That is Tencent and Alibaba, missing sales expectations for the March quarter, both failing to monetize AI as quickly as investors were hoping. And they're both now pledging to continue to invest in and leverage AI. And minutes from now, when Presidents Trump and Xi meet, there will be diplomacy as well as symbolism.
Mr. Trump is expected to tour the Temple of Heaven. It's a historic complex that's tied to ritual, to power, and to imperial authority.
The site has long been associated with cosmic order, political legitimacy, and imperial authority, making it a carefully chosen backdrop for high-level statecraft.
It's where Chinese emperors once prayed for abundant harvests and affirmed their divine leadership. Historian Lars Ulrich Thom, founder of a Beijing walking tour company, says the imperial site carries deep political symbolism.
This place is so important for the emperor because this was where he received the mandate from heaven, the right to rule China.
But the temple, built in 1420, shows the two sides' long history of connection.
When the structure behind me burned down in the late 1800s, you simply could not find tree trunks that were high enough. So where did you go? You went to Oregon in the US. And in Oregon, you found redwood.
This week, Trump will be eager to land some economic wins and prop up public approval ratings bruised by his war with Iran. For him, the site's hall of prayer for good harvest may carry some literal resonance. The president needs China to buy more soybeans, grains and meat from U.S. farmers, who are among his biggest electorate, ahead of November's midterm elections. China is the top market for U.S. farmers, but Beijing has dramatically scaled back its need for U.S. supplies, using it as a powerful lever against Trump's tariffs. Meanwhile, for Xi, the UNESCO-listed monument could offer more than just pageantry.
It's a very good backdrop to telling Donald Trump and to tell the world that China's here and has been here for thousands of years.
All right, it's time to go for a break. And when we return, it's live from Beijing, where tariffs, competition over tech and the Iran war and Taiwan on the agenda for the two superpowers as Presidents Trump and Xi meet. You're looking at live pictures from the Chinese capital of Beijing.
The American president's first official engagement will be an arrival ceremony with Mr. Xi at the Great Hall of the People. The leaders will hold talks before a state banquet scheduled for later this evening. Keep with us. You're watching CNA.
Fish like this are turning up in northern Thai rivers. What's being extracted in Myanmar's conflict zones that's poisoning rivers in Thailand?
How come the Upper Mekong become a sacrifice zone?
Thailand's poisoned rivers. Insight tonight on CNA.
South Korea's skilled laborers sent to Germany in exchange for looms.
나 자신을 발전시킬 수 있겠다. 가족들도 도울 수 있겠다.
Service and sacrifice that shaped a nation.
그분들이 지금 일을 많이 해가지고 많이 망가지고.
Adrift, the pioneers who built Korea. Tuesday on CNA.
Does working overseas make you richer? In Dubai, a young Singaporean finds out that tax-free doesn't mean earning more. When more money isn't always the goal, why she left for Sweden. And when the math stops working, why some choose to come home. Singaporeans working overseas. More money or a different life. Money Mind, Wednesday on CNA.
As a global energy crisis deepens, China doubles down on its plan for clean, limitless energy. Dubbed the Artificial Sun, scientists hope to crack the code on nuclear fusion. China China green tech exports surge, but other sectors face headwinds.
Exports are the key growth driver the past couple of years. And if the rest of the world is suffering, the scope for China to continue to export its way to growth is limited.
Can China play the role of peacemaker in the Iran crisis?
Typically, China has economic leverage over countries that act like normal, rational economic countries. Iran's not like this.
Watch When Titans Clash on demand at CNA.Asia.
Asia First.
Good morning. This is an extended version of Asia First. We bring you now to Beijing, where President Trump will be honored with a welcome ceremony before holding talks with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping.
I believe that's Mr. Xi walking down the stairs, and the presidential motorcade is just about arriving. Mr. Trump is on familiar ground here. He's at the Great Hall of the People, and this is where he's been before because he last visited Beijing nearly a decade ago, and that was during his first term as president. And it was also the last time that a U.S. leader stepped foot on China.
Yeah, he is here in Beijing on a three-day visit, arriving last night. Scrutiny goes beyond the pomp and pageantry expected of a state visit. The two superpower rivals will have their high-stakes sit-down in the coming minutes, both sides facing tensions on multiple fronts. We are expecting his motorcade to arrive. There you go. We can actually see his motorcade arriving, I believe, in the outskirts of Tiananmen Square, the Great Hall of the People on the western side of the square. Trade, Taiwan, technology and security, discussions on these areas, all will take place under the cloud of the Iran war that Washington believes Beijing can influence Tehran to change course.
And reports suggest modest expectations for the summit, for bilateral ties to be managed, to be stabilized rather than to be reset. Mr. Trump says he wants to ask Mr. Xi to, quote, open up China, so that the top business leaders who are traveling with him, and there's an array of them from very big companies, he's hoping that they can work their so-called magic. Reuters reports the U.S. and China are looking at cutting tariffs on $30 billion worth of non-sensitive goods, Beijing seeking equality and respect.
We also know, of course, that he has a delegation. We were just talking about that with him, and some analysts believe that cutting, you know, business deals, getting China to buy American goods is actually of the highest priority in terms of the agenda for President Trump. Meantime, China's ambassador to the U.S., Xie Feng, says both sides should strive to explore the correct way to get along in the new era. In his article for the People's Daily, Mr. Xie addressed the Taiwan issue as well, demanding the U.S. take concrete actions to abide by the One China principle.
Okay, at this present moment, the beast has slowed down and the man has stepped out of it.
That is
President Trump in his bright red tie. And next thing that we'll be looking forward to is the handshake that he will have with President Xi Jinping of China. Let's take a look at him walking up the stairs, the two leaders ready for the meet and greet. Here we go.
So just a reminder that they met in South Korea just over 6 months ago, where they announced, if you like, a detente in their trade war. So trade and tariffs very much on the agenda as well. At least one thing has changed, you know, since that meeting in South Korea, and that, of course, is the Iran war. A big question about how that is going to complicate the summit as well. And there is a lot of talk that President Trump will be hoping that President Xi will be pressuring Iran to come to the negotiating table and find a solution to the conflict that's taking place right now. And of course, high up there as well is reopening the Strait of Hormuz.
Meet and greet happening right now, Arnold. The high-level Chinese delegation shaking hands and being introduced to President Trump. And I remember just a few moments ago seeing also the American delegation standing by. Hey, for more on the welcome ceremony and what we can expect in the coming hours, let's get to our correspondents. Tan Zihui joins us from Beijing. Nick Harper is in Washington, D.C. And I'd like to start first with Zihui, who's always standing by when the motorcade goes by. Zihui, tell us the welcome ceremony for the president taking place at the Great Hall of the People. Can you tell us the significance of this venue on the western side of Tiananmen Square? And how does this compare to the last time that President Trump was welcomed in Beijing?
Well, the Great Hall of the People, that's where Mr. Xi greets foreign dignitary, top-level officials. So that holds great political significance. Just in 2017, he had met Mr. Trump at the same place, the state visit. It was accorded the state visit level welcome. That's the highest protocol that China offers. Back in 2017, Mr. Xi had personally greeted and welcomed Mr. Trump. And that's a key symbolism of how much level of respect that Mr. Xi accords Mr. Trump. We could expect this time around to for it to happen again. Back in 2017, we also saw the typical classic script of a state-level visit. We saw military honors, national anthems, also a typically tightly choreographed reception. And so we could expect that again this year. But what could be different back in 2017 and in this time? Back then, there was almost like a state visit plus Mr. Xi and Mr. Trump having an extended visit to the Forbidden City. That is the heart of Imperial China. Back then, the entire Forbidden City was restricted. Ordinary people could not go inside. And so it really gave Mr. Trump a kind of insight, reminiscent of what was like back in Imperial China. Mr. Xi and Mr. Trump having long talks along with their spouses. Well, whether we will see this again this time around, we will watch out later, because what we do expect and hope to see is that Mr. Trump could be going to the Temple of Heaven. It was one of the iconic attractions here in Beijing. That is also of historical significance. That's where emperors used to pray for abundant harvest and also to affirm divine leadership. And so that is of great political significance, great cultural significance. Let's see later whether Mr. Xi and Mr. Trump will have that kind of interaction later.
All right, Nick, as we look at pictures of the welcome ceremony for President Trump and I believe shortly a guard of honor and his inspection, we know that the president has made trade a priority. He has with him top executives from key U.S. Industries, and he's told China to open up. He wants China to open up to U.S. businesses. So what can we expect when the leaders meet for talks very shortly?
Yeah, Arnold, quite a heavyweight entourage that Donald Trump has brought with him. CEOs of about 17 American companies, some of the biggest in the United States, really making it very clear how central trade is to this entire visit. Along with Donald Trump, we have the likes of Apple, Meta, Boeing, Nvidia, a whole host of different companies, many of which already do business in China. And part of this visit is really about trying to do more business. So the United States is hoping that we will see more deals with some of these companies as a result of this trip, but perhaps also looking for some reciprocation, the opportunity for the United States to do more business in China and the opportunity, therefore, to have China opened up to the United States. Donald Trump says that these CEOs, this entourage that is with him, maybe to work their magic, in his words. Interesting to note as well that the US is very much pushing what it calls the five B's when it comes to trade, a whole range of things that it wants to do business with China on. Boeing, hoping to buy about 500 planes during the course of this visit. Soybeans, the hope is that China will buy about 25 million metric tons a year for the next 3 years. More US beef could be bought by China as a result of this trip. And then there is two boards being created, the Board of Investment and the Board of Trade. The idea there being that beyond this trip, there will be more opportunities for the US and China to interact, to cooperate and do more business deals beyond this visit itself.
All right, let's get back to Sehui, who's in Beijing. Boy, it looks like a fine morning over there, Sehui. And it's also been 9 years since Mr. Trump's last visit. Can you tell us how different today's China is compared to the one Mr. Trump visited in 2017?
Yes, 9 years is a long time and much has changed. China has changed, especially in how it deals with the U.S. Right now, the political climate between the U.S. and China, it has become more tense. It's more confrontational. It's more competitive now. And then the tariff war is no longer just between the U.S. and China. It's now out on the global stage. But analysts tell me that China is more prepared in terms of dealing with Mr. Trump's bargaining tactics and strategies. They know what Mr. Trump is like. They were previously probably caught off guard in terms of his personality. And so this time around, they know that they cannot be bullied. They are more confident now in terms of the leverage it has when it comes to this summit. Right now, they are more confident in terms of their financial systems. They also recently enacted new regulations to a sanctions law that counter foreign measures that target Chinese companies. They also know that when it comes to critical minerals, they can restrict rare earth exports to the U.S. So they're a lot more prepared now. Now, with that said, that doesn't mean that China does not place much importance on the U.S. They still place significant importance on this visit. As we've seen, Mr. Han Zheng, he is the vice president. He had greeted Mr. Trump. That is of a higher level compared to 2017 when a state councillor had greeted Mr. Trump. And so that really shows just how much respect that China still has for Mr. Trump and for the U.S. And China itself is also struggling in terms of its domestic economy, low domestic consumption, a struggling property sector. And so as much as the U.S. needs China, China also needs the U.S.
Nick, just want to get back to you now. This is a delayed summit, of course, delayed because of the war on Iran by President Trump. It's now taking place with the war still on. So I'm wondering, what is the U.S. leader willing to compromise if he's to ask President Xi's, for President Xi's help to end the conflict?
Well, it's a good question, Arnold. And indeed, Donald Trump was asked a version of this question just before jumping on the plane to Beijing. His response was that he didn't need China's help when it came to the war with Iran. In many ways, though, I think this is just posturing, because we do know that, of course, China has incredible influence with Iran. There are much closer relations on those two sides than there is between the US and Iran. So therefore, the hope could be that President Xi is able to exert his influence to get Iran to do a deal. But how will the United States spin this? I mean, I guess in many ways it could be that an end to the conflict is a win-win for both sides. Bear in mind that China gets about 30% of its oil from the Middle East. Much of that has been stuck because of the naval blockade by the United States on Iranian ports, but also because the Strait of Hormuz has been closed. So Donald Trump may suggest that really it's a good thing if the war ends for China. But the problem for the US president is China very much views this as Washington's war, Washington's problem. We have seen China's top diplomat, Wang Yi, saying that he wants to see the Strait of Hormuz reopened, but at the same time saying that Iran has the legitimate right to use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. There is one bit of leverage that the US president has that he could dangle as a way for China to use its influence over Iran, and of course that's the high-powered AI chips made by the likes of NVIDIA. But that is an incredible bargaining chip for the United States, and the US president may not want to use that as a way to end the war with Iran.
Okay, you're looking at live pictures right now. As we continue, at least we'll get to them shortly. Tan Zihui in Beijing speaking with us. Thank you so much for your reporting. And Nick Harper, we just heard from you from Washington, D.C. Appreciate your updates.
Let's bring in Drew Thompson. He's senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at NTU, and he is with us in the studio. Drew, good to see you again. I have to start by asking you about what you've just seen and what you're watching right now. This is a state visit, but it's not a state visit plus as it was in 2017. The handshake, you know, what's, you know, been made available to President Trump, the guard of honor and so forth. Do you see a big difference?
Well, I think what we're seeing in this pomp and circumstance is pretty standard level of protocol. And I think it's appropriate for the meetings. You heard the national anthems being played. I don't know if you could hear in the background the 21-gun salute. So I think this was a pretty standard protocol reception, and it was done appropriately. And that's important, right? I mean, China is going through exactly the right motions that they should. And don't forget, Xi Jinping has a reciprocal visit to the United States planned sometime later this year, and he'll expect the same level of diplomatic courtesies that he's received, that he's provided to President Trump. So I think that's normal.
Okay.
But I think now is where the action begins. They're going to sit down, and they're going to start to talk. He's got a big delegation with him. They've been having extensive discussions in the lead-up to this. I don't know what the state of all of those dialogues are and how far they've come. Is everything done and packaged and Xi Jinping can just bless it and Trump can accept it? Or are they actually going to have a little haggling left at the table? We don't know that. But I think they're in a good place to start those discussions now.
Okay, before we get to what they'll be talking about once, see the two gentlemen are walking into that great hall of the people. They'll be disappearing into one of the many, many rooms in this giant complex to actually start their talking. But, Drew, you heard our correspondent, Zihui, talk about how different China was in 2017 when President Trump was last there. What's your reading about the difference now between then and now? And also, your reading on President Xi, is he more of a confident negotiator when it comes to President Trump in this day and age?
So certainly Chinese interlocutors are trying to present President Xi Jinping as being in a very confident and comfortable position. There's been lots of commentary that he has all the cards and President Trump's cards have been diminished. And I'm personally skeptical about that framing. I think one thing that's changed is that President Trump is a second-term president. Mm-hmm. He's a powerful lame duck. He's prepared to take action. He doesn't have to care about his polling.
Okay.
He can pursue the course of action that he thinks is best for the country.
So that makes him bolder, even bolder than he may have been.
And perhaps more unpredictable as well.
Okay. I struggled at first. You heard Nick talk about the B's and then other people talk about
the T's
for China. But one way I found it perhaps easier to break this down is to look at it with 40s. The first one is Tehran. The second one is trade and tariffs. The third might be technology that covers AI. And the fourth is going to be Taiwan. So maybe we can take this conversation down that route. Let's start with the war on Iran. I mean, how do you see that shaping up? I was telling one of our guests earlier, I'm confused because China is clearly feeling the strain as well. It's the biggest importer of Iranian oil. But at the same time, it seems to be behaving like it has or was towards North Korea in a position to perhaps influence behavior, but not exactly doing that. How would you kind of explain this?
Well, certainly China is feeling the impact of the Iran war, but China's better positioned than most other countries to withstand the shocks from it. It has large energy reserved. It's got diversified supply. I mean, remember, the China-Iran relationship is asymmetric as well. Iran is more dependent on China than China is on Iran. 90% of Iran's exports go to China and only makes up less than 10% of China's. But I'd be cautious about how much leverage we think China has over Iran.
Well,
they have options too.
Mm-hmm.
China's buying that oil at pretty deep discounts. India would probably step in and purchase whatever China wouldn't. So China can't really threaten to not buy Iranian oil because Iran can find other buyers for it in the open market. So I think that's one element where we overestimate China's ability to really coerce Tehran. And we're talking about coercion here, not just friendly statements about how we should end the war, how we should open the strait. It's really about getting Tehran to keep in mind what Trump wants with Tehran. And so does Israel, so does Saudi Arabia, so does the UAE. There's an alignment here. They want Iran to give up its nuclear weapons, its nuclear weapons program. It wants it to renounce the nuclear weapon program. That's a primary goal.
Mm-hmm.
Regime change has been on the table as well, right? So it's not just about opening the Straits of Hormuz, which everybody would agree to. Hormuz is collateral damage here.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, would China be willing to actually lean into Tehran and, for example, demand that Iran recognizes Israel,
Okay.
which China does too.
Let me take the next tee, Arnold, because I think it's pretty cool. You came up with the four, so I'll go technology. All right? Okay. So Jensen Huang, will he not show up? I mean, he hitched a ride from Alaska on Air Force One, you know, ended up right there, just hot on the tails of Donald Trump walking off Air Force One as they landed in Beijing. What is, you know, the inclusion of Jensen Huang in, I guess, you know, whether he was going to be there or not, tell us about how sensitive chips and AI has become in this relationship.
Well, advanced chips are certainly one of China's top requests. That's a pipeline they'd like to open up. It's not clear, though, what China's offering in exchange. And that's true for Taiwan as well. There's lots of potential trades here.
Yeah.
And the U.S. certainly has a lot of interest in maintaining its lead in AI development.
Okay.
And it's more than just chips that's being restricted. It's also U.S. restrictions on semiconductor manufacturing components as well. So I think the competitive element is going to remain. And even if there is an opening for more advanced chips to be shipped to China, you're still going to get restrictions in other areas where I think China would like progress.
So I want to ask you about this delicate dance, this delicate balance, if you like, because the U.S., if it chooses to restrict, you know, NVIDIA chips, for example, China is going to forge ahead, work with Huawei or, you know, give lots of incentive to Huawei to come up with their own chips. Is the U.S. going to say, okay, fine, you go ahead and do it? Or is it going to try and kind of, suppose, influence the whole process in some way while protecting its own interests and making sure that China doesn't fully go its own way and come up with its own AI, with its own chips and so forth?
Well, there's two competing strategies being articulated in the U.S. One is that we should be exporting advanced technologies and get China essentially addicted to U.S. technology and then perhaps save some of their own equity in developing a homegrown one. But I think Xi Jinping is very committed to his industrial and technological resilience. You know, he wants to be decoupled. He doesn't want to have the specter of U.S. embargoes hanging over him. So I think that the billions of incentives that have gone to the semiconductor industry in China are going to continue to flow regardless.
So right now, as it stands in the short term, Xi Jinping will still be hoping to get those advanced chips, but at the same time, developing China's own advanced chips? Is that what you're saying, basically?
I think that's the smart strategy, and that's the one he'll pursue.
Okay, Taiwan. Let's go to the third T. Not there, but part of the conversation. What do you think Taiwan's going to be looking out for, and how much does wording matter in this instance?
So it's important to remember that Taiwan is always a part of every discussion with China at almost every level. Even at staff-level discussions, the Chinese counterparts will raise it with their American counterparts, and they will emphasize how important, critical, central, red line this issue is for them, core interest. So that's the norm. The question is how the U.S. responds.
Yep.
Does the U.S. respond with a brick wall, or does it think about ways that they may give reassurance
right.
to Taiwan? And we've seen that in the past as well. So I don't know how it's going to play out, but honestly, I'm skeptical that President Trump is going to make trades for minor concessions from China, because there's real questions about whether they'll be made at all.
Pete Hegseth's there, Arnold.
Okay.
Do you see him? Secretary of Defense, just moments ago, Marco Rubio.
A principal player, I would have to say as well, when it comes to Taiwan. But Drew, I want to just, you know,
just
press
quick thought
you.
On Secretary Hegseth. Yeah. I think he brings real credibility to the Iran discussion.
Okay.
Not just Taiwan.
I mean, it goes to show that, you know, that's on the agenda and he's there.
And he's there to support his president
yeah,
to make understand. Sure that they're discussing you know, the capabilities
of there play. Too.
So going back to this unpredictability, you know, that we see from Donald Trump, I'm wondering how this plays into the whole Taiwan issue. I mean, the fear from middle countries, including countries like Singapore, would be that, you know, he goes for a quick grand deal and somehow leaves troops, you know, withdrawn from Japan or, you know, the Philippines exposed. I mean, are we reading this correctly or is the Trump administration actually a bit more stable and thoughtful about this entire issue?
So I think it's reasonable and understandable that smaller countries would be worried that their equities would be traded away.
Yeah.
I think that's normal. And that's, quite frankly, predates the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. I think there's a constant relationship of reassurance that the United States does with smaller partners. So that's normal, and I think it's appropriate. But when you look at U.S. equities towards Taiwan, when you look at all of the people you've just mentioned on the delegation, their positions are very clear. I think if you listen to the White House briefing before the trip, they were also explicit that U.S. policy towards Taiwan has been consistent, and they don't expect it to change. Remember, I think, the important thing is how President Trump negotiates. He revels in uncertainty. He wants to get to the table and have his counterpart not have any idea where he's going to stand. And he thinks that gives him maximum leverage. So he really revels in disinformation. And that gives him, I think, strength. So they don't know what they can offer in exchange.
Okay. I'm very pleased to meet you in Beijing. Welcome back to China after 9 years. The whole world is watching our meeting. Currently, transformation not seen in a century is accelerating across the globe, and the international situation is fluid and turbulent. The world has come to a new crossroads. Can China and the United States overcome the Thucydides trap and create a new paradigm of major country relations? Can we meet global challenges together and provide more stability for the world? Can we, in the interests of the well-being of our two peoples and the future of humanity, build a brighter future together for our bilateral relations? These are the questions vital to history, to the world, and to the people. They are the questions of our times that you and I need to answer as leaders of major countries. This year is the 250th anniversary of American independence. Congratulations to you and to the American people. I always believe that our two countries have more common interests than differences. Success in one is an opportunity for the other, and a stable bilateral relationship is good for the world. China and the United States both stand to gain from cooperation and lose from confrontation. We should be partners, not rivals. We should help each other succeed and prosper together and find the right way for major countries to get along well with each other in the new era. Mr. President, I look forward to our discussions on major issues important to our two countries and the world, and working together with you to set the course for and steer the giant ship of China-U.S. relations so as to make 2026 a historic landmark year that opens up a new chapter in China-U.S. relations. I will pause here and hand over to you, Mr. President. Thank you.
Well, President Xi, I want to thank you very much. First of all, that was an honor like few have ever seen before. And I think I was particularly impressed by those children. They were happy. They were beautiful. The military is obvious. It couldn't be better. But those children were amazing, and they represent so much. And I know they represent so much to you. You and I have known each other now for a long time. In fact, the longest relationship of our two countries that any president and president has had. And that's, to me, an honor. We've had a fantastic relationship. We've gotten along. When there were difficulties, we worked it out. I would call you, and you would call me. And whenever we had a problem, people don't know, whenever we had a problem, we worked that out very quickly. We're going to have a fantastic future together. Such respect for China, the job you've done. You're a great leader. I say it to everybody. You're a great leader. Sometimes people don't like me saying it, but I say it anyway because it's true. I only say the truth. And I just want to say on behalf of all of the great delegation that we have the greatest businessmen, the biggest, and I guess the best in the world. We have amazing people, and they're all with me. Every single one of them, we asked the top 30 in the world, every single one of them said yes. And I didn't want the second or the third in the company. I wanted only the top. And they're here today to pay respects to you and to China. And they look forward to trade and doing business. And it's going to be totally reciprocal on our behalf. So I really look very much forward to our discussion. It's a big discussion. There are those that say this is maybe the biggest summit ever. They can never remember anything like it. It's, I can say, in the United States, it's people aren't talking about anything else. But it's an honor to be with you. It's an honor to be your friend. And the relationship between China and the USA is going to be better than ever before. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, opening remarks there from the two leaders ahead of their meeting and negotiations. Drew, let's get you in here. I mean, what do you make of those comments? And I will point out that President Trump, anyway, was more focused on trade, on getting deals. He did mention some of the other issues that we talked about. So that's the last T, trade and tariffs. So maybe we can get you to talk about their opening comments and, again, look into this fourth T.
I think, to begin with, both sides spoke respectfully. I think, importantly, the remarks were brief. I think if we were expecting more contention, you would see much longer talks, much more confrontational, much more filibustering.
Okay.
And I think the fact that Xi Jinping's remarks were so brief, high level, strategic, that I think that's a good sign for where they're going. Trade has always been or President Trump's top priority for China, and I think that's reflected in his remarks. Yeah.
And for President Trump, the political value of this trip will depend heavily on deliverables. We know there's a lot of pressure on that. He likes these visible wins. What kind of deliverables are you particularly watching for, Drew?
Well, of course, the Board of Trade is one of the expected outcomes, the announcement that there'll be a new structural dialogue that the two sides will be able to engage on trade regularly. I think a lot more will need to be hammered out, and it will become more apparent what the structure will be, what the content will be, who the participants will be, how the private sector will be involved. But I think it's worth noting that, you know, we've had trade relations with China for a long time. We've had trade dialogues with them that were structured, annual meetings, multiple layers. For example, the Joint Committee on Commerce and Trade was founded in 1983, but ended in 2016. And it didn't really meet the objectives of opening up China, which, remember, was, you know, a commitment made in 2001 when China joined the WTO. Right. So here we are 25 years later, basically asking for the same thing for 25 years. So I'm skeptical about how the Board of Trade is going to actually fundamentally change the nature of the bilateral trade relationship, how it'll change market access in China.
Yep.
But what it might do is provide more managed trade.
Right. A good word. I also want to ask you where tariffs stand in this picture right now. President Trump, we know, tried it. Didn't really work. It brought tariffs to record highs, but China retaliated. So both countries lost out. The rest of the world lost out as well. So does this still remain a tool, you think, for the U.S., for the Trump administration, as they go into talks about trade as well as tariffs?
So I think President Trump is emotionally still very committed to using tariffs as a point of leverage, but also using it as part of industrial policy. He wants to bring manufacturing back to the United States. He wants to try to use tariffs to balance trade with not just China, but the rest of the world. So he's using it to drive investment. He's using it to essentially achieve some of the same resilience objectives that China has long had. Mm-hmm. So I think the uncertainty due to the court cases, the up and down nature of the level of tariffs, I think also has the effect that he's looking for, which is uncertainty, which is going to drive more investment towards certainty, which is investing in the United States.
Yep.
So whether the tariffs go up or down and court cases change them, he's going to continue to press for more tariffs, and that's going to encourage investors to continue to invest in the United States, which is his goal.
Okay, so this whole idea of a board of trade and board of investment, I mean, are they really things which could work, you know, in the real world between the two countries?
With national security considerations as well worked in.
So, again, we don't know what the charter of these two organizations is going to be. We don't know membership. A board of investment, I'm not privy to their internal discussions. Is it going to be a screening agent or a promoting agent would be a first question I would ask. Is it there to encourage trade or to restrict it into areas that are non-controversial, that are not treading on national security areas?
Right.
So it could be a channel or it could be a block. And we have existing mechanisms like CFIUS, which is a screening mechanism where all foreign investors, not just China, any acquisition has to be reviewed by the United States government. So is it in conjunction with that is another question. But, I mean, fundamentally, anytime you're going to have the U.S. and Chinese sides meeting regularly, negotiating in good faith, whether it's towards increasing trade or increasing investment, I think it's fundamentally positive. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't agree on every issue, they're still building trust. They're still building understanding and creating more opportunities for exactly the positive economic activities that both sides want.
Okay.
You know, one reason that China can be really confident, you know, sitting across the table from the United States is the fact that it's got the power of the rare earths, right? And I just wonder if rare earths could become China's equivalent of tariffs, perhaps, a tool to signal displeasure without direct military sort of intervention and escalation?
Well, rare earths coercion creates a bit of a dilemma. So every time China does that, it encourages more investment in rare earths production capacity around the world. You've got Japan, who's been working for years on synthetics. You've got Malaysia, Australia, United States. So you're basically driving people away from your threat.
Yep.
So it kind of reduces over time. Mm-hmm. There's also an incentive for those at rare earths trading companies to get their product to market as well. So it's very difficult for, I think, Xi Jinping to lock it down completely. It'll be a very difficult task to completely embargo. He'll make it more difficult. He'll increase prices. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be as rare as he hopes. So I think it's got limited utility. At the end of the day, though, it's not good for China's image. Mm. I mean, China's being the hegemon that they decry everyone else being. And I think it's not conducive to trust. It's not conducive to relationships that are durable.
Right. So, Drew, as we hit to wrap up this conversation, I want to ask you a little bit about the four T's once again. Does trade and tariffs, you know, look like perhaps the easiest to, if you like, overcome and something with the immediate returns and that would give both sides something to talk about, you know, and to present domestically as well of the four? Or do you see something else which might be easier to achieve?
So I don't think we're going to see absolute victory. I mean, it's quite clear. Trade is President Trump's top priority. Yeah. Taiwan is clearly a very high priority for Beijing. I don't think either side's going to get what they want.
So what will we? So ultimately, what are we going to end up with then? You know, when Trump leaves tomorrow, is he going to be just going home with some deals? Is there going to be some codifying of trade arrangements or rules to manage potential conflict? What, you know, do you see actually, you know, coming out of this summit?
So I think the best case would be we come out of the summit with goodwill, good atmospherics. We've certainly started that way. I think if we consider also that Xi Jinping is expected to make a state visit to the United States this year, you've got potential meetings in Shenzhen and in Miami for the G20 and APEC. Later this year as well. So you've got three more touch points between the two presidents where I think there's a high likelihood that they'll try to maintain this positive atmospherics, work through problems, small incremental steps, not dramatic changes.
Right.
But I think that's positive. Now, can we continue to sustain that constructive, cordial relationship? It may not be friendly, but it's cordial, and avoid moving into confrontation? That's a big question. What happens in 2027? And if you go back to the first Trump administration, where we were in 2017, they were on very good terms. They were having great bilateral meetings. They were visiting the sites of Beijing and having dinners together. But a year later, the relationship was taking a turn for the worse. So the question is, will it follow that same pattern of high pageantry, summitry, an inability to actually make substantive progress on these core issues, and then a return to more acrimony and potentially confrontation, which both sides want to avoid. But it is still a possible scenario. And I think that would be the worst case.
Never know. We might just see Drew again for part two, part three.
We'll have to see what happens tomorrow, you know, when they release some sort of statement about the success and what they achieve at the summit. Drew, meantime, we want to thank you so much for coming in to talk about, you know, this summit. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you next time.
My pleasure.
Drew Thompson is Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at NTU. Okay, diplomacy as well as symbolism. It marks the meeting between the two presidents. Mr. Trump is later today also expected to tour the Temple of Heaven. It's a historic complex that's tied to ritual, to power and to imperial authority.
The site has long been associated with political legitimacy and imperial authority, making it a carefully chosen backdrop for high-level statecraft.
It's where Chinese emperors once prayed for abundant harvests and affirmed their divine leadership. Historian Lars Ulrich Thom, founder of a Beijing walking tour company, says the imperial site carries deep political symbolism.
This place is so important for the emperor because this was where he received the mandate from heaven, the right to rule China.
But the temple, built in 1420, shows the two sides' long history of connection.
When the structure behind me burned down in the late 1800s, you simply could not find tree trunks that were high enough. So where did you go? You went to Oregon in the US. And in Oregon, you found redwood.
This week, Trump will be eager to land some economic wins and prop up public approval ratings bruised by his war with Iran. For him, the site's hall of prayer for good harvest may carry some literal resonance. The president needs China to buy more soybeans, grains and meat from U.S. farmers, who are among his biggest electorate ahead of November's midterm elections. China is the top market for U.S. farmers. But Beijing has dramatically scaled back its need for U.S. supplies, using it as a powerful lever against Trump's tariffs. Meanwhile, for Xi, the UNESCO-listed monument could offer more than just pageantry.
It's a very good backdrop to telling Donald Trump and to tell the world that China's here and has been here for thousands of years.
For more than a decade, President Xi has urged officials to tell China's story well. But some of the most effective storytellers today aren't officials or even Chinese, but Americans with smartphones.
Yeah, there's a growing trend. It's known as China Maxing. It's reshaping perceptions of the country and could add a new dimension to today's summit between the U.S. and the Chinese leaders. And Tony Waterman filed this report for CNA from Washington, D.C.
From Chinese herbal teas to Mandarin music tracks, scroll through social media these days and you'll likely catch some very unexpected faces caught up in some very Chinese moments. This is Chinamaxing, a viral trend that's hitting a high note, often with a cheeky tone.
A lot of us have been recently diagnosed Chinese.
They're mostly Western Gen Zers, maxing out on Chinese culture and daily habits.
So first we are going to drink hot water.
This is the first time in my life that I've taken my shoes off at home, and it's liberating.
The clips have garnered millions of views and caught the attention of top Chinese officials, including China's ambassador to the United Nations.
China is next level.
But instead of a genuine embrace of Chinese culture or politics, experts say Chinamaxing reflects young Americans' frustration with domestic issues, like political turmoil, gun violence, the high cost of living, and unhealthy lifestyle.
They are picking up their phone. They're seeing this really interesting, cool, clean, new, different set of, maybe it's foods, maybe it's architecture, maybe it's transportation, maybe it's infrastructure, maybe it's fashion. But this looks cool, and my life doesn't feel that cool.
Either way, it's seen as a form of soft power for the Chinese government, which, alongside things like labubus, animated films, and viral Chinese rappers, is helping to shift young Americans' perception of a country widely regarded as a rival and, at times, an adversary.
For older Americans, China was about COVID, was about Taiwan, was about democracy, human rights issues. But for younger Americans, they see China through daily life. They see China on apps, products, short videos, fashion, even video games. So that everyday familiarity is lowering this psychological distance.
A Pew survey in April found about a third of Americans under 50 years old have a favorable view of China, compared to just one in five older adults. And that, experts say, could influence the dynamic when Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping meet in China this week.
Policymakers will find it much harder to rally the public support for, say, aggressive containment if the young voters don't feel the hostility toward China as before.
This is economy, which was $20, and this is...
Critics also caution that the trend oversimplifies the reality, which is that China shares some of the same challenges as the U.S., including slowing growth and an aging population, and youth unemployment is much higher in China.
But what Chinamaxing shows us is that influence can be shaped by perception, and that soft power is a formidable tool, one that both the U.S. and China have wielded for decades through attraction rather than coercion. But in the age of social media, that power is no longer solely in the hands of governments, but also in the palms of individuals. And experts say this could be even more powerful than state messaging. For CNA, I'm Tony Waterman in Washington, D.C.
And just an update that the Trump Xi summit is currently underway. Talks are happening as the leaders confront trade and Iran, among many, many things. We'll continue to bring you coverage of the meeting.
Also, please follow us with the latest on our live blog on our website, cna.asia. You are watching CNA News and Updates continue after this short break.